So the next section has to do with verses 5 through 7 of chapter 7. 5 through 7. It's better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. For like the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This is vanity. Surely oppression destroys a wise man's reason, and a bribe debases the heart. Now you look at these phrase, these proverbial sayings in this particular text, and one of the styles that you find in the Proverbs and here as well makes it kind of difficult for us to get a cogent section to where everything is talking about the same basic thought. In other words, these sayings are very simple, and sometimes you might have in just one verse after another talking about two entirely different subjects. And so he does a pretty good job in this section to kind of categorize those. But I do think like verse 7 doesn't necessarily tie in entirely with what we see beforehand. But in this particular section, he talks about the importance of listening to even the rebuke of wise individuals. So you have what is the typical response. Nobody likes to hear an admonition. It's not something that is pleasant, and we don't enjoy it. Our children do not like for us to get on to them or to rebuke them for something that they have done. They would much prefer being with their friends and having fun. But the point here is that wisdom is the important thing. And of course, that's one of the reasons why the book of Ecclesiastes is referred to as one of the books in the wisdom literature. Solomon placed a great deal of value upon the concept of wisdom, though he himself, being wise, often acted in foolish ways. What the book of Ecclesiastes does is indicate an experiential wisdom, indicating that these are the things that he's learned by the things that he's done. And so these are practical things that he's recognized. So in regard to this, wisdom comes to us, he says, in various ways. And you think about what are the things that we've learned in life and where those things came from. He mentions a parent who offers the counsel of experience, don't do this because I did it. I can tell you it's not the best thing to do. A teacher who takes an interest in our accomplishments, a coach who inspires, a physician who tells us what we need to hear, spiritually an elder or preacher who admonishes us. Basically, he's saying whenever you hear someone who's trying to tell you something important, something that's going to help you and benefit you in your life, even though it may not be the easiest thing to hear, it is definitely better. It's more valuable than listening to the hear to the song of fools. So the comparison is what is kind of interesting in verse one or point number one under letter E, the crackling of thorns under a pot, and he makes this point: you can build a fire with thorn bushes, but the fire won't last very long, and perhaps. Some of you have that experience. You hear the crackling and everything, but it doesn't accomplish what a good piece of wood would accomplish with regard to a fire. And so the idea is that when we're talking about value, you want something that will benefit you, not in just the moment. And that's what humor basically does. That's what laughter does. You are uplifted. There's nothing wrong with it, but there's nothing particularly valuable about it with regard to learning lessons, how to live your life, how to conduct yourself. So that's I think the idea that's established there. So let me move over sideways since there's nobody on that side today. And so that's I think it's a better than a comparative description of this. It's not an indication that there's anything intrinsically wrong with or lacking in value with regard to humor. It's just that when you compare it to wisdom, which comes from rebuke and admonition and correction and instruction, the value is much less. So it's not this rather than that, but more this than that is what's under consideration with regard to these particular examples. All right, anybody want to add anything to that particular section, verses 5 through 7? He does state in point number 2 that verse 7 indicates that a wise man can become unwise. He says, oppression destroys a wise man's reason, and a bribe debases the heart. And as far as oppression destroying a wise man's reason, I think that probably has to do more with an individual who, because of wisdom, gets in a position of influence where he can oppress rather than one who is oppressed by others. I don't know that there's anything intrinsic about being oppressed that would destroy our reason. But there are certainly individuals who, you've heard the phrase that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So wisdom often will get us in a situation or circumstance to where we have authority, we have influence, but there is a corrupting aspect to that that can lead us to become oppressive to others. And I think that's I think that is what the wise man is talking about in that particular section. And then the second part of it is there that a bribe debases the heart. And that is, again, the concept of being in those positions that wisdom can put you in can lead to corruption and debasement. And bribery is one way in which that might happen. So it's not really related to verses 5 and 6, but he puts that in that section. All right. Next one, then, is the first part of verse 8, where the end of a thing is better than its beginning. And he posits two possible explanations of that phrase, the end of a matter is better than the beginning. He says this is Solomon's way of saying that wisdom comes with age. Years and life experiences have given older people perspective that younger people do not have. There is truth in that. I think that the passage, it seems it fits better with his second explanation, which is in the box there, that he could also be saying that finishing a goal is better than starting it. It just seems that that's what that means. The end of a thing is better than the beginning. To finish it is better than starting it. And we know that that's the case. The reference there in 2 Timothy 4 is to Jesus, is to Paul's statement, I've fought the good fight, I've kept the faith, finished course to kept the faith, and there is a crown of righteousness that is laid up for me. Of course, when the wise man writes, his lessons are not only with regard to eternity, but in the lives that we live. And so you have individuals who will begin a project and they don't have the stick-to-itiveness to finish it. And there are an awful lot of people that have these big dreams and big goals and big ideas, and they don't follow through. And starting a project, sure, there's value to that, but it hasn't any lasting value unless you finish it. And I'm guilty of that in a lot of areas and a lot of ways. One that kind of comes to my mind is every year in November, which is a horrible month for this to happen for me at least. But it's called National Novel Writing Month. NaNoWriMo is the short term for it. Kay Cornell has written a number of books in the month of November. She's good at finishing what she starts in regard to that. But the idea is that in a single month, you write a short novel, which is about 50,000 words. Last week, I wrote an article that was 5,500 words, and I wrote it in a day. So, you know, you can do it. But it's also the month of Thanksgiving, and it's also when we have our gospel meeting. And so there have been four different occasions that I thought, I've always wanted to write a novel. I'm going to write, you know, this month, and I'm going to finish the 50,000 words and at least have a start on something that I can polish and maybe do something with in the future. I have started it four times, not come close to finishing it either four times. I think the most I got was about 8,000 to 10,000 words before, you know, living my life day by day and the obligations I have gotten in the way, and I never follow through. And then the thing about it is, the idea is in that November, in order to be doing it the way they want you to do it, although nobody really, I mean, you don't get a prize or anything other than saying I did it, but you're always supposed to start a new book. So I can't go back and work on the one that I I did before and say, hey, I did a novel in a month. So I've started 4 books and not done anything with them. And
you need to pick a different one.
And actually they've made some changes where you can't do that. November's not good. So that's it. You know, you go with great expectations to start something and excited about it, but stick-to-itiveness is important in regard to goals that you might have. And all of us have felt that at some point in time or another, to where we have actually accomplished our goal. We've gotten to the end of it. And there is great value and joy to be found in that, but there's not in other situations and circumstances. So that's a point to be made. The primary and ultimate point of that is it is a good thing to start living a life as a Christian. But how many people have you seen who have become obedient to the gospel, and yet, as the parable of the sower indicates, for whatever reason, whether it's the rocky soil or the seed that fell among thorns, something precludes them maintaining their faithfulness till the end and bearing fruit. And so that's extremely important. So that's a good point to be made there at the first part of verse 8. Anybody want to add anything to that? You don't want to be just preaching this morning. Y'all have any comments? Feel free. And then the latter part of that the second part of verse 8, the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. I don't know if any of you saw that, but I put a little video out on Facebook this past the past week. I do that on Tuesdays whenever I can get it into the schedule to do it. And I read a short passage from The Screwtape Letters. It's a book that C.S. Lewis wrote. And the premise is of a tormentor or tempter who is writing to his nephew. And he's a senior. He's done it for a long time, tempted men. And this is his demon nephew is a novice. And he's got his first Christian that he's trying to tempt to lose his faith. And he's getting on to the young man because he's allowed him to develop the characteristic of humility, and because that's destructive to the to Satan, which is their employer. So it's kind of an interesting construct there. But he said something very interesting about humility, and that it is something that the devil hates and God expects of us. And so the idea here is that the best way to handle humility is to make him proud of being humble. So if you draw his attention to the fact that, hey, I'm being humble, then he'll be proud of the fact that he's being humble. And then if you say, and then if he recognizes, hey, I'm being proud of being humble, then make him proud of the fact that he recognized that. You can go on. It's kind of an easy trap for us to fall into. This haughtiness, this pridefulness, this arrogance. And it's the foundation of sexism. It's the foundation of racism. It's the foundation of ageism. And that, of course, goes both ways. The different races thinking that they are superior. The different genders thinking they're superior. And of course, we live in a patriarchal society and have the world is I think, under the control of men in general. So there is that oppression of women that's very prevalent. But I don't know how many times I've heard, for example, in politics, where basically saying if women were in charge, the world would be a much better place. And I keep thinking to myself, well, wait a second. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I don't know that there's necessarily any superiority of any gender in that regard. And the same thing with age. How many times have you seen the dismissive response of the young? One of the things that really, really bothers me, and I see it even those who are well-intentioned, but I see older individuals nearing the end of their lives, because of that there is some frailty physically. Doesn't necessarily mean that there's any frailty in their mind, other than maybe some forgetfulness. But their children and grandchildren still treat them like kids. You know, in other words, it's a cloying, oh, they're so precious, they're so sweet, that kind of thing. You know, and yeah, they're right there. You know, it's like they're people, and that treatment of older people is, I think, a function to a certain extent of our society, because our society places a great deal of value upon the youth and the young, and the older you get, the more irrelevant you are. Older people are set in there, and a big part of this is societal, because with regard to advertising. You know, older people have already said they're what they prefer, and so whenever some new product comes out or some new push comes out, they know they're not going to really have much sway with older individuals who already have it the way they want it. So they ignore them and go for the young. And there's it's just a societal thing to where there's so much emphasis upon youth, and so there is an ageism that exists. Now, having said that, it can also be very much the case that there is ageism on the part of the old toward the young, pining for the good old days and the way young people used to be, and they're not that way anymore, and being prejudiced against maybe a specific individual just because, in general, you don't approve of the way the world's going, and those kinds of things can be present. That all of that comes from a sense of haughtiness, arrogance, that I know best, I'm better than they are. And that's completely inappropriate. And so what humility does, and I think humility cannot be separated from the concept of patience. You talk about the patience of Job. You look at Job's patience. What was the motivating factor of his patience? God's in control. Who am I to tell God how to? You know, God gave these to me. God can take it away. That was humility in his part, which allowed him to patiently bear up under the tribulation that he experienced. And so, it's important that we develop humility rather than haughtiness. And that's a difficult thing to do, but it's important. So I like that particular phrase: patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. Now he mentions two things here. To develop humility instead of haughtiness, we must guard against two things. The first, and those two things are found in verse 9 and 10. First of all, and I don't know that it really kind of follows, it's tied in together, but there's some truth to what he's saying here. First of all, in 9, do not hasten in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools. And so we need to guard against anger. Again, anger, to a very great extent, when I feel anger, it is because of some personal affront. In other words, something has impacted me negatively. I'm concerned about myself and how I feel and how I've been treated, and so I react angrily. So when we see that humility is tied up in the concept of selflessness and pride and selfishness, then a prideful individual will react negatively to anything that happens to him that he perceives to be inappropriate or unfair, and as a result of that will react in anger. And again, when you see an individual who is patient, an individual who accepts a fault with equanimity, one who is slow to anger, typically you have a selfless person who's not so much concerned about himself but concerned about others. So anger is something that is very much tied in with the idea of a haughty spirit or arrogance. It may not be something that is necessarily obvious to us, but it's there. And it's much easier for you not to become angry when you're mistreated. Your concern is not for yourself but for the person who's mistreating you. Oh no, what he's doing is endangering his standing with God, and he needs to be admonished, or he needs to have it explained to him. He needs to repent. You're concerned about him. You're not concerned about yourself. You're less likely to be angry. So I think that's a good point to be made. And then the second, and by the way, the two passages that are found here, Proverbs 16, he that is slow to anger is better than the mighty. He who rules his spirit than he who takes a city. And then Ephesians chapter 4, be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath or give place to the devil. Those are the two that says don't be angry. But I'm more interested in that idea that how anger, if we feel that personal affront, we need to examine our hearts to say, okay, why am I being angry? Why am I so concerned about myself? Why am I focusing inwardly instead of outwardly on this particular circumstance? More concerned about myself than the individual who may be the one who is in danger. That's what in Matthew 18, if a brother sins against you, go to him and reveal his fault. You've mistreated me, so I need to make sure you understand that so that you can repent, so that you don't lose your soul. Not you've mistreated me, I don't like you anymore. You've mistreated me, how dare you? There's a difference in the approach, and it all has to do with humility or arrogance. And then the second one, in verse 10, do not say, why were the former days better than these? For you do not inquire wisely concerning this. This a little bit ties in, and I guess that's where I got this idea, the ageism that we mentioned before, how things have changed. And I think that's kind of interesting. And again, tied in with self-identity to a certain extent. There are a number of things that are inappropriate about it. For one, is that when we talk about the good old days, we're looking through rose-colored glasses. I wish we would go back to the 50s. Well, there were a lot of things about the 50s that weren't all that great. But we romanticize those things that are in the past. But again, some of that idea is the idea of self. So when was I, at what point in time was I most relevant? What was the pinnacle of my life? When was I the most tied in and central with regard to my involvement in the lives of other people and such? And typically we're going to say in the past. I mean, how many times have you seen a situation where a high school football player, every time you talk to him, he wants to relive the time that he had on the gridiron and how successful they were. And he talks about that over and over and over again because, that was kind of the high point of his life. And what's happened since then is not nearly as compelling as what he did when he was young. Well, again, you notice that kind of sense of self that's tied in. I want to talk about those kind of things, those times, because those are more important to me. All of us do it to a certain extent. You get together with older preachers and listen to them talk, and they're reliving the battles of the institutional issues or others. And for one, you give experience, certainly, but another is that, hey, I was doing something important back then, and now maybe not so much. So that's something we have to guard against, is that perspective of well, why do we think that we look back over our shoulder, why do we think that that was better than this now? A lot of it ties in with how we felt about that. Have you seen that, the objections that are raised to Donald Trump's Make America Great Again? Which, I don't like Trump at all. We're concerned about where culture is going and how things have changed. But there are a large group of people that are saying that the phrase "Make America Great Again" is inherently racist. That's ridiculous. Inherently racist? What does it mean by that? But understand the perspective. You say "Make America Great Again." When was it great in the times past? Okay, let's say it's great in the 50s. Well, that was before the civil rights movement in the 1960s. That was during the time of segregation of the Negroes and the whites. And all of these kinds of things. Also, misogyny that existed, where the woman was expected. I mean, you go to some of the advertisements in the 1950s of women. How do you prepare for your husband coming home? And you make sure you put your makeup on, and make sure you do this, and make sure you do that, and have all, because he's worked hard during the day. And they say that's so misogynistic. That's just horrible. But Make America Great Again. This is the high point of American culture in the minds of some. So their response is, when Trump says Make America Great Again, what he's saying is Make America Great for the white males again. And you'll hear that those objections being raised. And there's some legitimacy to it. I'm not saying that I agree with that idea that it's inherently racist, because it's certainly not. But we do need to understand that when we think about the halcyon days of old, that those things were great because that's when we were young or when we were vital or those, you know, that's when we were at our pinnacle or whatever the case may be. And we look at those things fondly. And again, it very much ties in with this idea of self. And he mentions the things that were present. And again, things change as time goes on. Now, you know, I thought that it was kind of interesting that Debbie and I have always listened to 98.7 on the radio because that's the oldie station. And when we moved here, you know, the oldie station was 1950s, and 10 years later it was 1960s. And, you know, and now we're up to the 1980s, it's oldies music. Now, wait a minute, 1980s is not oldies. You know, that's when I was in high school. So the perspective changes with regard to this. But you notice what he mentions here. Polio was a major threat to the children in the nation, you know, in the you know, 30s and 40s, and the segregation of the restrooms and restaurants, and the long, hot summers, which were exactly that because there wasn't refrigerated air conditioning. And that out, it says, yeah, sometimes you forget that outdoor plumbing was outdoors. Can you imagine such a thing? You know, in our day and time, say, okay, you know, I have to go to the bathroom. Okay, go out back to the outhouse. Now, some of y'all did some of that. I was fortunate to be born and live at a time where indoor plumbing was the norm. But, you know, you don't want that again. So those times are not necessarily.
Didn't have it then.
No, yeah, I understand. No. But you look fondly back on that period of time in your life. Well, you may not.
Not that part of it.
No, not that part of it. I'm just saying that the, you know, things have changed so much, and so we sometimes look with nostalgia back. Nostalgia is fine, and we're not saying that it's not. It has to be within this point of that selfishness, that feeling of self-importance. And as time passes and a new generation takes a position of prominence, there can be resentment that is there, and there can be discontent that is present. Whenever you see such resentment, discontent, anger that we're mentioning here, a lot of it has to just tied in with this sense of self of I'm sensing that my importance is waning, and I don't like it, and because of that, I react with resentment. Or react with anger, and that's where the sin comes. And I think that's the emphasis that we want to make in regard to this point. All right, it's a little, it's a rather subtle point to make, but it's I think legitimate good.
I have found that I don't know if it really ties in so much to that. I guess it does, though. But living life as a widow—that is a problem, has been for me, as far as. I guess the remembering and the wishing for and the trying to accept, you know, I mean, this is the way it is.
Yeah.
And I realize that, and I'm okay, you know. I don't know.
And that's I do want to make that distinction because I think that's legitimate. We have several widows here, so we want to make that point. In fact, most of you are widows, so not all of you, but most of you are. But there's a difference between nostalgia, looking fondly back at the time when your life was more full, especially with a partner, especially with your husband. There's nothing wrong with that. I don't think there's anything illegitimate about it. What can become destructive with that is if an individual turns in on himself or herself. And as a result of that, that's the focus, and it makes their life miserable. So we're not talking about pridefulness or haughtiness in this regard, because even within the text of Ecclesiastes, there is an indication in chapter 12 of how difficult life becomes when you get older. And that's why it's important to get your life in order when you're young and not to waste that, because life gets more difficult as you get older. So we recognize that that is the case. But having said that, how do you deal with it? And I think one of the best ways of dealing with those issues of, you know, and it's not to cast aspersion by any means, but in effect, feeling sorry for yourself, because there is that. I mean, I'm not as happy as I was. I'm struggling because of what I've lost. Feeling sorry for yourself, sorrowing, is something that is natural. It's a part of grief and part of the process, but it can become debilitating. And the best way of handling that is get outside of self and focus on others. It's not an easy thing to do, but it is. And you see the individuals who thrive best after the loss of a spouse are those individuals who then say, okay, I'm going to focus on helping other people. I'm going to be involved in the lives of other people. I'm going to be not concerned with self but others. And you can, I don't say fill the void, but you can, you know, when the focus is not inward but rather outward, it becomes easier to exist and deal with the issues. And that's why in the earliest days of grief, a person has a difficult time even coping at all, because it's all inward. The loss is too new, it's too difficult to deal with, and you're thinking about it constantly, and it's all about me and what I've lost and such. And again, those are natural stages. There's nothing inappropriate about them. But the individuals who cope best with their grief are those who lose self a bit and instead focus on others. So selflessness is very beneficial and helpful. Humility, very beneficial in every aspect of the life that you live and dealing with these kinds of things. I don't want to, that's why I wanted to make that specific point, that there's nothing wrong with nostalgia. There's not anything wrong with looking fondly back on the past. But an individual who is self-centered and is not happy with life because it was better when I was young or whatever the case may be, and that selfishness can lead to a lot of problems. And whether it's, a legitimate loss that where, the loss of a spouse, I can't even imagine and how debilitating that would be, and how debilitating it would be for me. But again, you see people cope with it, and the ones that do best are the ones that become selfless. They focus outwardly instead of inwardly. So there's good lesson to be learned in regard to that as well. Laura, you had something too.
Okay, and I was going to say this before.
Right. Completely different topic.
Yeah, but I was going to say, when we remember back on different things, we remember the good things. We don't always remember the bad things at that time. So, you think back, when you were a kid, I had no responsibility. I could go out and play. I could do all this stuff. But I don't have what I have now. So you have to balance it. But if we concentrate so much on the old, we would never have what we have now. And you can lose so much of it. You make yourself miserable, I think, being in that way. So there's a lot of good about it, but we also have to remember, you have to remember the whole picture. So.
But are there not a lot of miserable old people?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to, because I'm getting to where I can put myself in that little category where, time has passed us by, family is maybe no longer as considerate as they were the past of us, and we can become angry or depressed, bitter as a result of those things, and a lot of it again has to do with how the world impacts me. It's the natural thing. The most important thing for me is me. No one else is in my head all day long. I am, and no one understands me like I do. And as a result of that, it's the natural state of all men, and it's something you have to work to get beyond. That's why humility. I mentioned in that Screwtape Letters, your patient is what they refer to. Your patient has learned humility. You have to learn it. It's something that doesn't come naturally. A child is very, very arrogant. A small child, everything's about me, 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 me. It's mine. Give it to me. That's their attitude. They've got to learn to be selfless. They've got to learn to be humble. It's not an easy lesson for them. And a lot of people don't learn it.
Jim and I were talking the other day about Jim and Arlene Everett. And I remember we were talking about that. He would get up and always introduce before he would read scripture. He would always tell you where, and I said, how much I appreciate that, because sometimes when you start at a certain point, you're like trying to figure out where he is. But he was always so kind and so upbeat. And you could tell they had so many problems with, health-wise and everything. But they were always very positive on things. And up until the day they died. And it was just a very good example to set forth, but I think of them with this. So.
Yeah, good point. Anybody else? Okay, so that's some good stuff. I really think. I'm glad that we discussed that a little bit. As I've grown older, I think I've seen a tie-in, humility tying in with every aspect. I mean, the concept of being humble, of selflessness, looking outside of self, it impacts the concept of pride. It impacts the idea of love, the expression of love, charity. Being humble, not concerned about self, it's impactful to unity in Philippians chapter 2. Not look out for your own interest, but look out for the interest of others. That was within the context of being of one mind. It's unity, love, all of those kinds of things kind of center in the idea of getting away from selfishness. And it's an important point. All right. That gets us to the top of page 34, which is the second section. And again, we spent a lot of time on this, so we're definitely not going to get through this part because there are quite a few verses here. It goes from verse 11 all the way to the end of the chapter. But there is a lot of good to be found here as well. So looking at verses 11 and 12, we're told that wisdom is good with an inheritance and profitable though to those who see the Son. For wisdom is a defense, as money is a defense. The excellence of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to those who have it.
This is not a good time to leave.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine.
It's very good.
All right. See you later. So when we talk about this idea of wisdom, he puts it as wisdom gives protection. And that is a takeoff of that statement in verse 12. Wisdom is a defense as money is a defense. And so it's a different kind of defense, but it is a defense just like money. So when we talk about money being a defense, insurance wasn't known back then, at least not in the same concept of insurance as we have today. But I think my dad has told me once that you can become insurance poor. You're putting so much money into the various kinds of insurance, whether it's health or life or insuring your car or your home or your electronics or whatever the case may be, that you spend so much money. But there's a reason for that, and that is because of the protection it affords us. You don't need insurance until the day you need it, and then you're glad you have it in those situations. So we see that. Now, a rich man doesn't necessarily need that, because if a rich man gets sick, he can pull out his checkbook and pay for the doctor. Money is definitely a defense in that regard. Protects us. But how does wisdom protect us? Well, he mentions that wisdom protects us with money. that's the first point that he made, I don't think it's intrinsic to the text, but that's a good point, is how many individuals... They talk about the people who win the lottery, how a lot of those people eventually are bankrupt, because they don't know how to handle money, and so they get the money and they blow it. And then they get in the same state that they were before. How you can blow $5 million, I don't know, but they do. And it's because they don't have that wisdom to handle their money correctly. That happens so many times with athletes. Every once in a while you'll hear an athlete who signs a big contract and his agent wastes all his money and he's broke and he didn't know it. But a lot of times it's not that. It's that they blow through their money. There are two individuals that come to my mind. Both of them came from very poor circumstances. Both of them are boxers. Mike Tyson is one, and the other is I forget what his name is. He's the most famous middleweight, because he's the one that's presently fighting. He's just about retired, but he's made more money than anybody ever. And he's in trouble with the IRS, because he's making tons and tons, hundreds of millions of dollars, but he's spending it as fast as he makes it. And Mike Tyson has very little money left. He's blown like two different fortunes, and now he gets by on appearance money, thing like that, to try to maintain some semblance of lifestyle. So those kinds of things happen because they're foolish in the way they deal with it. There are a lot of other individuals, athletes and others, who have had the same amounts of money or lesser amounts and turned them into fortunes because of wisdom. So wisdom gives protection. Now that's, again, an aside, Because there are many other things where wisdom protects you more important than just with regard to financial circumstances. He puts at the end of this paragraph, money protects you financially, but only when it is joined with wisdom, which is the point that we're making there. But I think that when you look at this, when you talk about the defense of wisdom, there's some significance to that. Wisdom is a defense, as money is a defense. The excellence of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to those who have it. So he starts by talking about the money and how wisdom and money combined is helpful. But wisdom helps in everything. And I like the way we look at that. Well, why is wisdom so important? Because wisdom protects you. The whole point of Proverbs is, son, learn from my mistakes, because I've made them. Now, you don't have to if you listen to what I have to say.
But you also have to look at Solomon. I mean, Solomon was given this wisdom, but you have to use it. So you can have the... He didn't always, listen to it. So you can have the wisdom.
Solomon's a conundrum. I've never really understood that. He was so wise. He was given wisdom because of the purity of his heart. But there was some corruption that took place there to where he did so many foolish things.
Well, that's almost like he won the lottery.
Yeah.
He was given all this stuff, but...
Well, and I guess, part of that, though, is by living and experiencing all the things that he did, he prepared his son, the Proverbs written to my son, and also us as well, by extension. So we have the product of that wisdom that is not just God given, but also learned from experiences in life and mistakes made that are beneficial to us. But yeah, you have to use it. How many times have you heard someone say, "I knew I shouldn't have done that"? That was a mistake, and I knew it when I was doing it. But that's where temptation comes in. So a wise man can avoid a lot of error, but only if he implements the wisdom he has. That's a good point. All right, anything you want to add to that? Verses 11 and 12. Then we go down to verses 13 and 14. Consider the work of God, for who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful, and in the day of adversity, consider. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man can find out nothing that will come after him. So a couple of things about here. We're talking about five benefits of wisdom. Wisdom gives protection. Wisdom gives perspective here. And the idea here is, we don't know what's going to happen in life. But we know God's in control. And as such, whether good things are happening to us or whether bad things are happening to us, God is in control. We have that perspective, and we can trust in him. So you'll notice the last sentence in that paragraph, the basis of wisdom is trust. Simply trusting faith that God will provide. And I think that's something that's difficult for us to do as well. The willingness to let go of control. To recognize that we are not ultimately in control of anything. Some of us are more control freaks than others, but all of us have to understand to a certain extent or another that we're not in control. And that's a beneficial and healthy thing to do. God has made something crooked. We can't make it straight. We can't do that. One of the things that is interesting to me is how men have sought for such a long time to control things that are uncontrollable. And how impotent we are in the face of those things. So you take as an example prediction of earthquakes. Earthquakes are devastating. So you have the tectonic plates, and they're pushing up against each other, and there's friction, and it slips, and here's an earthquake. So what can we do about it? Well, they've worked. There's a science involved in this. We want to be able to predict earthquakes, because if you predict earthquakes, you can save lives, get people away from the structures and such that would fall on them and kill them. And through all the work that they've done, they've managed to actually be able to predict earthquakes. They know within like 2 or 3 seconds before it happens, it's going to happen. Yeah, so what good does it do? And the same kind of thing with regard to hurricanes and with regard to tornadoes and those kinds of things. But, so what man has done in his great power, we can control things. We've gotten to, okay, we can predict when something is going to happen. Now, so here are the hurricanes coming. So everybody get out. And then it veers the last second and goes maybe to where you went out to. Who knows? But maybe they get it right. But they can't stop the hurricane. You can't stop it. You can't stop the tornado. You can't stop the earthquake. You can't change things. You can't move the mountain. You can't make the earth warmer or the earth cooler when it's too cold or it's too hot. So God has made that crooked, and we can't make it straight. That's the point of it. God is in control. And men rail against that. They don't like it. Men don't like not having control. But if we have that perspective that God is in control, then you know that's what leads to this willingness to give our lives over to Him and to trust in Him. Who else are you going to trust in? If you trust in yourself, you're going to be disappointed because you aren't in control. There are a lot of things that you can't help or stop or fix, but God is, and we can trust in Him. So I think it's a good point to be made there as well. All right, questions, comments about that section, verses 13 to 14. Okay, 5 more minutes. Let's go to one more point. This one is, I think, a good one. Wisdom gives balance, but it's one that is difficult somewhat to understand because it almost sounds contradictory. I've seen everything in my days of vanity. There is a just man who perishes in his righteousness. There is a wicked man who prolongs his life in wickedness. Now, we recognize that's the case because accounts are not settled here on this earth. So sometimes bad men prosper, good men suffer. But he says in verse 16, do not be overly righteous, nor be overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Do not be overly wicked, nor be foolish. Why should you die before your time? It is good to grasp, or it is good that you grasp this, and also not remove your hand from the other, for he who fears God will escape them all. So do not be excessively righteous. Do not be overly wise. What could that mean? And I think that really he does a pretty good job about this, about being excessively righteous. He uses the phrase, like the Pharisees. And one of the things that I thought was kind of interesting when I went over to the Bible lands, had opportunity to go over to Israel, and one of the places we went on the northern shore of Galilee was the town of Chorazin, which no longer exists, but it was one of those that was given a curse by Jesus because the evil that was being done there and their unbelief. But there at Chorazin was what was referred to as a mikveh, which is a ceremonial bath that the Jews at that time had. And so you would go down into the bath and you would wash yourself. It was a ritual that was done to show yourself as righteous and cleansed. And of course, there are still practices among the Jews with regard to this kind of cleansing that is done in a type of it's rather peculiar, and I don't even know what the actual ritual is. But I do remember that when we went to a motel, that there were, you remember the pots of water that were adjacent to the restaurant or the where we were eating, and running water out of a faucet for some reason wasn't acceptable. The water had to be in a pot, and they would pour the water on their hands rather than having it run through pipes, because it was a part of the ritual. It wasn't so much of an actual cleansing, but as a ceremonial cleansing before they ate, which is harkening back to the Pharisees and the Talmud and all the traditions in that regard. But I remember Mike Willis, who was kind of guiding us in that, he said, one of the reasons why Jesus had so little patience with regard to the Pharisees is because the Pharisees created all these rituals that only the rich, only those who had not necessarily a life of leisure, but a life that was tied in entirely with the observance of the rituals, could keep those things. And the poor man who was having to work and who was filthy, because, he didn't use those bad, didn't have time for them, wasn't invited to them. These were the religious people that were sitting around that would cleanse themselves, and this was a place of gathering and a place of socializing and everything where they could look out on everybody else and say, look at all those ungodly people out there and look at how righteous we are. And that was something that was kind of telling to me, because the mikvahs were not used by the Jew the mikvahs were used by the Jewish leaders, by the religious people who were binding their own traditions above and beyond what the law required of men, and saying, we're better than you because we're doing this and you're not. And that's overly righteous. I think that's a good example of it. And we need to be careful not to be guilty of that same thing. And then overly wise is mentioned as well. And he mentions here, as in your own eyes. And that is this, again, this perception of where... So pride comes in to this again.
It's like an oxymoron. You're wise, but you're not really wise.
There was an individual who was a member here at Westside for... I won't name his name because it's not important to make this illustration. But he came up to me one day and he said, Stan, it just really bothers me that nobody wants to talk about the Bible. No one wants to talk Scripture. So I try to, Mark had started these conversations with people and he don't want to talk to me about it. And I told him, I said, the problem is not that they don't want to talk about Scripture and religion and the Bible. They don't want to talk about it with you. And the reason why is because he was intimidating and he had that air of, I'm better than you. And his desire to talk about these things was to tell people what they're doing wrong and how they should change and what was best. And that was that overly righteous idea that we're talking about here. And it was, a lot of people love to talk Bible, but they didn't want to talk Bible with him. And perhaps you've come across someone like that in the past where you just feel real uncomfortable because of how they present themselves, and it seems like they're looking around trying to find how much better they are than other people are, and they leave that perception. And that would be what we're talking about here in this particular text. He's not saying, you cannot be too righteous. What does righteous mean? Righteous means without sin. So he's not saying here, sin a little, just don't sin a lot. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, don't be obnoxious in your righteousness. Don't be obnoxious in your wisdom. Don't be arrogant. Which is actually unwise, but that's the point being made here. So I thought that was a very good point to be made. So live godly, draw closer to the Lord, but don't lose touch with humanity and reality. And when other individuals decide that they want to engage in recreation, and their idea of recreation is not sitting down and opening up the commentaries and spending 8 hours just digging in, don't think that you're better than they are because they like to go play golf. It's a good thing too. So that's the point that's being made. And it's an interesting thing, and let me tell you, it's something that I think preachers have a problem with, because it is our job, and other people do not have the time to involve themselves in Bible study and such as those who are supported in the gospel. And so, it's right for us to call individuals to be studious and to learn. It's wrong for us to be arrogant or to perceive others as ignorant because they don't know as much as we do in any particular matter. And I think that some preachers have that kind of attitude. They're up there not to share and to explain, but to show how smart they are. And that's problematic. And I see that from time to time. I don't see it very much with older preachers. Although there can be that pride and pomposity that is there, but I do see a lot of arrogant young men that I've been studying a couple of years now, look what I know, and I got to tell everybody how much more I know than they do. And I've seen that in young men some. It's kind of disturbing. I've told this story before. There's a young man that he wanted to talk with me about preaching, and he still refers to me as a mentor of his. And so I said, sure, let's go and talk. And so we went to Kincaid's and sat down across a burger, and he spent the next 2 hours talking to me and explaining to me about preaching and his theories and his views of it. And I listened intently to him. There wasn't a whole lot there, but there was some that I gleaned from it. But he wasn't interested in asking my advice. He was going to tell me his, and I thought, because he came across like, I want to learn from you, and then he dominated the conversation. Okay, well, all right. that's fine. And I learned some things from him, so I guess that's good. All right, comments, questions before we dismiss the class?
Yeah, I was just wondering,
Appreciate very much everyone coming today. I'm glad that we're back on a little bit of a schedule. So we will start there on Wisdom Gives Strength next time and get through the questions as well. And if we've got time, we'll get into the 8th chapter. All right. Appreciate y'all coming.